And we're welcoming today Brian Warby and Gabe Fishman of Open Air Boston and Aaron Kaepern of Funkfreuer Austria. Gabe's over here. And when I couldn't read this because I'm not wearing glasses, so I thought it said Cyanide Wi-Fi Networks from the bottom up. It's, the word is Citywide Wi-Fi Networks.
Although, some days.
There are, if you need to make them fatal, you can do that on very short notice. Anyway, so I'll just let you guys go right ahead with it and tell us what you're all about.
Thank you. Again, I'm Brian Warby. I'm the CEO of OpenAirBoston.net. I've brought my colleague Gabe Fishman from OpenAir and Aaron Kaplan, who's come all the way to us from Austria just for this 1 hour. No, he hasn't. He came to do programming work for us this week. I am going to turn it over to Aaron in the spirit of time because Gabe and I are local. If we need to come back, we run out of time, we need to come back, we can certainly do that. But I really want Aaron to get to a lot of his good work and learning on the Funkfreuer network over the last several years, many of the lessons from which we've tried to incorporate into some aspects of the Open Air Boston program. So with that, Aaron.
Thanks.
Okay. So we'll try to switch up now. Okay, so I'm very honored to be here. Thanks. So what I'm going to talk about is you know the three important things that I think Lessing said that, right? Open source, we need open source, open hardware, and I'm going to talk about open networks. I think, you know, in the future we'll need a fourth ingredient to the magic formula, which will be something like open power grids or open power networks and better optimized transportation systems. But now I want to talk about the open networks that we built in Europe. So I'm going to talk about people climbing on roofs, going to talk about patching things together in a way which were never intended to be. And I found this really, for me, this was a very, very interesting quote from Bertolt Brecht. He envisioned, in my opinion, the internet, like a long time before it was even here. And he said, what happens when the radio becomes a two-way communication device? You know, it was a push-only medium before. It helped dictators. It helped, dictators in Austria and in Germany to speak to the masses. So now we have this two-way communication system and this vast network of pipes. He used the word pipes. It was really interesting. I think we still have pipes, and inside of those pipes, five optic lines. And I think we're now... We proved in Europe and also some areas in the States that actually this two-way communication network can exist, that it can get big, and it can be done. So currently, the internet. What's wrong with the internet? Few things, but among them is it's a scale-free network, which is good on the one hand, bad on the other. You can take out a few central nodes, and you can eliminate communication. So there's a lot of concentration on a few key nodes, which would be in the U.S., Florida, and East Coast, West Coast, Central data centers. And I think, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think like early generations of network pioneers envisioned often something more meshed, maybe. Or at least I had the impression. So I think we can have a different structure in addition or in parallel. We need the existing internet as it is now, but we can have something in parallel which is pretty meshed. This is actually a almost live picture of the Vienna mesh network. I took that 20 minutes ago, the screenshot. And you can see really it's like a spider went berserk. we can see very, very nicely that long links are not really a problem. We have a few green, meaning good quality, very long links, and short red links. So the properties of radio interference are more of an issue, actually, than distance. So this is
These are all wireless, right?
These are all wireless. Yeah. So this here is the central part of Vienna. Spreads out a little bit more here, a little bit more here. And Red is a bad link quality, so too many packets are lost here. Yellow is okay, and green is good link. So it's just an easy parameter to see ourselves if the links are
so
good.
So there are links to individuals?
There are to people who build things on their roofs.
I see. Okay.
Some are going 10 kilometers.
30.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You want to go into what technology you're using for that?
Sure. I'm coming to that. So let me just maybe, we can see that maybe live.
Oh, I see.
This is the live map. I can zoom in here.
Cool.
And you can see in first aspect of the, an abstraction of the Fresnel zone, where the radio signal is best. We just did a line, and you can see where it cuts through a hill, so you can easily estimate if the link will be good or bad. So the longest links are actually, that's why I wanted to see it now. Whoops, sorry.
3D
buildings. Yeah. Nope, I wanted to actually. Yeah, that's what I needed. So I wanted to show you basically the distance is not a problem because we can go halfway to Bratislava, which is here. So this is a 30 kilometer link here. Okay. Yeah, stop. Nope, not my mails. Okay. So the way we did that is we used lots of panel and directional links for the long distances, and Omni, the round antennas, for local area. Okay, so this network is, from an abstract point of view, a little bit less scale-free. So the exponent and the formula for scale-free networks is a little bit smaller. So we're much more meshed. That means for routing path algorithms, we can take more different routes. That means it could be, in theory, more stable and redundant, actually. In case one node fails, the idea is that it will just route around it. And I would say it's more anarchic because people built those nodes. It was not an ISP. It was not us who built the nodes. We just built the initial nodes. And actually, the protocol would allow mobility. So theoretically, you could move the roofs around or have cars or something like that, or cranes with mobile nodes on top. Okay, so why did we do that? Why did we do that? What was actually the motivation? I think at that time, we have to see it a little bit in context. At that time, the data retention laws were coming to the EU. And they were widely discussed, and build Wi-Fi networks which are in the hands of the roof node owners, and therefore not really operated by an ISP, and therefore nobody could come and say, okay, take down that node, because the recording industry doesn't want that user. Basically, that would mean, in case somebody wants to take down the node, you would have to cut all the connections to the node. But that's not so easy with Wi-Fi, because anybody can basically connect and pass on the packets. So the other aspect that was really important for us is to have our own network. It's a matter of owning your own infrastructure, not relying on some ISP selling you the infrastructure, but actually owning it. And in the course of this, we found out that self-sustainable solutions are absolutely essential. Otherwise, of course, it wouldn't last for very long, this experiment. Good. Now, these types of networks happened all across Europe. Vienna is not is just an example now, because I lived there and I knew exactly how it was built. But This also happened in Amsterdam, in Berlin, in different cities in Germany, in Paris, in around Barcelona, and in Athens. So in Vienna, it was like that. We started with this anonymous hotspot. We wanted to build an anonymous hotspot because the data return channels were coming at that moment, and we wanted to see, is it possible to have a hotspot where people can just surf the internet without being logged? Okay, so it was more of a legal issue, actually. And we were counseling with lawyers. We talked with them and asked how would the data protection laws... it's like that. We have strong data, as you know, strong data protection laws in the EU, and the data protection laws say you're not allowed to log longer than you need for billing. So after the billing process is finished, you have to remove the log files. So the solution was pretty simple. We said we didn't bill. There's no billing process involved, so therefore we have to remove the log files immediately. We asked the lawyer if that's actually true, and this became sort of the standard model for hotspots now in cafes, because they don't want to do all the logging. It's just too cumbersome. It's not necessary for them. So you have this splash page in the beginning, terms of use, accept, and that's it. No billing involved. I think it's originated here, at least in Austria. So that's where we got to know Wi-Fi is a pretty interesting media for us. And we started to think about how can we do that in the developing world. We didn't go there. We didn't manage that yet. I think old PC has been doing more here and others. But we found in a book that somebody wrote about this hotspot and about a network which was being abandoned. Wi-Fi and experimental network. 10 roofs. And we asked we called the guy and said, do you need those roofs? Do you need those initial 10 roofs? And he said, no. I mean, I would stop that project anyway, because he was using too old technology at that moment. So what happened is we went to the roofs. We looked at the equipment. It was old stuff, too expensive. We replaced by very cheap Linksys routers with OpenWRT, flashed them, had our own Linux on top of him, and started to experiment with mesh. And we tested different protocols, and at that moment, the OLSR protocol was the only usable solution. So there would have been different ones, but at that stage of the development, it was actually what we found usable. So actually, then we invited the public and said, you know, we're building this network. You're allowed to join. The only conditions for joining the network would be, if I route traffic over your node, you have to pass it on. And vice versa. That's the only condition. Okay, so where are we now? What did we achieve? You saw the picture in the beginning. Pretty large network. I just counted before. We have 674 entries in the routing table. That means probably around 500 devices, really, and 240 roofs. And this whole network has been repeated in the second largest city in Austria, in Graz, in rural areas, and that's where they really need it. In Vienna, we actually don't need it. It's an experiment. We have fiber optic connections, theoretically, to almost every house. They just don't turn it on, because that would kill all the other ISPs. But the city built it as part of the sewer construction works. Okay, halfway to the distance to Bratislava. We have a very active community, and actually we're starting to do our own fiber connections now, because that's where you have, of course, the massive bandwidth. Okay. I said before this happened, yeah?
You said you're doing your own fiber connection in the middle mile, and how are you funding
it? Okay. That's pretty expensive in Vienna to dig correctly, yeah? So what we did is we're sharing the costs with the owner of a house where our co-location center is. I'm coming to that. And basically, we had to save for it. that's the answer. We really had to save for it. And we're handing... DSL?
Existing nope. services, or are they all hopping to a shared point of access?
Very often in Europe, they share DSL lines. For us, we actually wanted to share the uplink because we're in a special situation where we were really lucky. We started right across the Vienna Internet Exchange. Across the street, there's the Vienna Internet Exchange. So the fiber optic connections below the street, they're still easy to do. We can't invest millions, but we can invest this one distance, this one road. So
yes.
We're offering the bandwidth from that roof for free to everybody. So these networks happened in different forms in parallel. Each of these networks is very different. I'm describing what happened in Vienna, but in Berlin, for example, they shared DSL lines. In Jerusalem, they started to care for their own connectivity on the whole countryside because the telecom industry left that out. They decided it wasn't efficient enough and wouldn't pay off to invest in that region. Jerusalem is in Denmark. It's a far-off region in Denmark. And they started to with Wi-Fi, and now they're doing all kinds of different technology. Then Barcelona, all around Barcelona, there were unserved areas. So there's a ring of Wi-Fi all across Barcelona, around 5,000 nodes. That's one of the biggest ones that I know. Athens Wireless is, they like to do their own things anyway, so they're very independent, and they created a network which has 2,400 nodes approximately now. The Paris network is not so big. I think it's sleeping, a little bit dormant right now. And a very interesting network is the Czech Free Network, which is covering almost the whole country. All the cities are covered, and I'll show you some pictures of that. Okay. In Vienna, in the Funkfire network, it's very similar to the Berlin network. We have been coordinating all the time. We developed the things in parallel. So the most important aspect of it is the peak-peering agreement, meaning free transfer. If I set up a node, I will allow anybody to hop packets over my node and vice versa. And the rest is done by the mesh routing protocol, which finds the proper paths. So if one node fails, or if somebody moves out from that flat, has to take down the node, or the wind comes and crashes it, it will route around it. Okay, so I said before, the bandwidth is provided by us. How we're going to do that, I'm coming to that shortly. And we keep it intentionally as an experimental network. So that means it's dual. Sometimes people want to have their internet working, and then they will, of course, say, oh, we experimented with the network right now. But it still happens. We're trying to reduce that massively. We're trying to have two virtual networks on top of each other, one stable one and one experimental one now. But that's the definition. So the interesting aspect is, of course, that the network itself is a value. There's no real commercial interest in the network, but having the network and having it running on its own is already a great value. And funny enough to see is that we have a very interesting text here on all of our splash pages. I think you know it. It's in a standard Freifunk framework. I don't know how often it's cited, but and all of our routers is there by default, just to make people understand, you know, what they're using actually. So I think you know that text. Okay, so who is involved in that community? Many students from IT and electrical engineering. So we have a very high nerd factor. But we also have a heart surgeon in our group. We have a journalist, a dentist, and you would be astonished how well dentists can make antennas. It's amazing. It's totally amazing. He invented a small antenna, Yagi antenna, looking into a satellite dish, and made it tunable. And he just used his dentist tools for that. And of course it attracts radio amateur folks. And they see it as the next logical step, right, from amateur radio. And then we're in close cooperation with folks from OpenWRT, so our experiences go back to OpenWRT. Does anybody not know what OpenWRT is? No? Okay. Branch of the OpenWRT firmware is, it's a firmware for small routers, for something like this. This is you probably know, this is a cheap $50, $40 phone hotspot router, and we program it with our own software, and a lot of it is based on OpenWRT, and OpenWRT is like the Swiss Army knife of embedded devices. And the Freifunk firmware, where your text is on the splash page, is just a branch of OpenWRT. We collaborate with the Open Hardware Initiative in Paris. Many of them are in Paris, actually, at the Temp Lab. And of course, the OLSR project, open source mesh routing project, became something of its own, and very close corporations, of course. Okay, now I think you were also very interested, like, in the financial sustainability, because when you offer bandwidth for free, where does it come from? Somebody has to pay for it, right? So what we did, our solution is, we had this great space really across the street from the Vienna Internet Exchange, so we had bandwidth. And we said, okay, we'll just build our own colo sender. So you can see Wolfgang, who is now working at Ripe, actually working on the switches while they're operating. Terrible. So we built three rooms like that. And people can put their servers in there. They will pay a regular fee, a little bit below market rates. So that is cheaper, but they can host their own stuff there. And the excess bandwidth that we buy bandwidth, and the excess bandwidth is put into the wireless network. And you would be astonished how little a wireless network actually needs. So for all these nodes, the calculation is very simple. For all these nodes, we need approximately 10 Mbit average. Of course, there are spikes, but the average is 10 Mbit. This is nothing. So the uplink is here, gigabit fiber connection. It's multi-homed. We became local internet registry. That means we have public IP addresses. We're officially part of the internet. We're going to Ripe meetings. And yeah, I talked about the Colo Center. So we prefer projects in the Colo Center which actually help the internet in the wider sense. So we're very proud of having hosted the ORSON project, which is the alternative root server network. So in case the idea is, in case the root servers become extremely political, there's a second set of root servers for DNS root servers. I don't know if everybody is familiar with that project. But it's pretty interesting. So it's like misusing the root servers for political purposes is like a one-shot attempt. The second time, people are going to have root servers in places like here. Okay, loved by the communities of VoIP server. So this is totally a killer app. People use VoIP over the Wi-Fi network. It works. And we have local content, local TV and radio stations hosted in the Colo Center.
Is that VoIP service, is that just Skype, or is
that Asterisk? It's terminated and it's outgoing also. So we have outgoing calls for free. And it works like that. We have a big pot, and you know, when you use it a lot, people ditch in 10, 20 euros. And it works out financially. It's not really expensive.
What about latency in some of your mesh networks? I mean, because yeah, you have different paths.
Yes.
Do you have problems?
Good question. Generally, the network quality of the Wi-Fi links we try to explain to people how to set up proper links. And usually that involves lots of directional antennas or panel antennas. And once they set up good links, latency is usually good. But it's really tricky to get it right. So there's actually some education involved. Yeah. And if somebody doesn't manage to set up a proper link, he probably will have packet loss. That's it. Yeah. So we don't come to that person and like an ISP and you know we won't fix your internet. We will teach you how to fix your own internet connection. That's the difference.
And so the stations that you basically have are your only backhauls, and the rest of it is passed around node
yes.
to node.
Yes. Actually, we intentionally try to keep the number of nodes that the association legally owns to a minimum. We want to have the ownership out there.
But you have other backhaul locations that tie into the regular internet as well.
Yeah, the call center is actually the handover point.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
it used to be one point for a long time, and it was interesting on the one hand because it was a question of how big we could make a mesh network with OLSR with only one uplink. But eventually it worked out that we have two and now a third one is coming. And this is a slight disadvantage of having public IP space. Because in Germany and Athens and everywhere they use private IP space, so they can NAT at every DSL uplink. And we have to accept the public IP space at certain BGP handover sessions. So we need proper gateways. Yes. Yes. One way to solve that technically is we do employ some wireless bridges in addition to the mesh. So this will bring actually the backbone closer to the consumers.
And so proper includes distributing information about what the architecture of the network is on an ongoing basis.
Yes. Yes. Via mailing lists, via meetings. We have actually I think now that you mention it, it's one of the most important aspects of the network is actually regular workshops. Yeah. And somebody will just learn BGP and explain it to the rest. Yeah. That's how it works. Okay, I talked about the other networks already a bit. I just want to give you a brief impression of the size and the effect that these networks have. This is the Athens wireless network, and it's just one screenshot, one part of it. So this is really below it. There is a city. Here is the mountain here, and below this network is Athens. And they actually hop across islands already. And they're different Greek networks. It's not just the Athens wireless network. They have it in between islands. And it fits naturally to their geography. You know, have a big antenna on the mountain, on the island, and it will just hop over to the next island. You can see, when you're on top, you can see the other islands. So it fits. It's totally logical for them to do that. I talked about the check-free network. You can see here, lower right part, you can see the map of the Czech Republic. And that's roughly this area here. And around Prague, everything is totally covered. So this is the Prague area. And Freifunk is a very well-known name, and they have many cities in Germany. And there's a brief update from the Freifunk network. For the first time, we cross-connected different Freifunk networks with the OLSR routing, just in order to prove that it scales to thousands of nodes in practice. We did that recently. It does. So this is the Leipzig network, just the topology. And Yeah, if you want, I can talk about the protocols themselves. I wasn't sure if that's interesting for... No? Yes? No? Okay, I'll skip that in case you have questions. Okay, I think I should hurry up now. So, lessons that I want to share with you is I think making it a community-based effort is actually the most democratizing thing you can do, because people start to build their own infrastructure, and therefore they start to care about it. They start to protect it usually, and they learn, they empower themselves. And actually, you can do it, even without lots of cash. We started with virtually zero, and then, you know, a couple of us put in a little bit of money into it. We bought the remains of a dying ISP, took the parts, the switches which we needed, sold the rest, and just worked ourselves up. And yeah, internet access for free is, you know, is very tempting. You can really get people involved in that initially, and then eventually they will actually understand that there is something more behind it, not just internet access for free and just consuming it, but actually creating it on your own. The lesson is also you can really have good connectivity with very little bandwidth, average use. Of course, you need to be able to to sustain the spikes. When somebody really downloads something, you need to be able to give them the spikes, yeah, and that's where Wi-Fi is weak, actually. Yeah, we need better layer 2 technology. But you know, still 20 to 30 megabits is doable for us. People get effectively 20 to 30 megabits netto over good links. If they construct bad links, it can be as low as 15 kilobytes per second. Yeah? Still enough to get email, but slowly. Okay, so for that we pay really little. We're at the right spot next to the Vienna Internet Exchange. All the ISPs are there. It's cheap for us to buy bandwidth, €200 per month. That's sustainable. And we need some kind of backbone, exactly, because of the mesh, the multi-hop classical ideas of the mesh with 8, 9, 10 hops on the same channel, that doesn't work. We need to have, so the backbone is really multi-channel. It's totally multi-channel. So I think it's called Generation 3 mesh networks in some papers. We need more of that. We need to have more frequency. We need to have better Wi-Fi equipment. We need to go in probably into the direction of MIMO. I can see that really coming.
What's MIMO?
Multiple in, multiple out. It's phased array / beamforming. So the antenna will just be able to listen. It's like you have 5 ears. So your 5 ears can cancel out the noise from back here and listen to back here very carefully. Or, you know, you can steer the beam if you want
phased.
To. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a phased array, basically.
What flavor of Wi-Fi are you using?
802.11 ABG, all that we can get. We need as much frequency as possible. That's also something that I want to come to later. We just really, opening up the spectrum is essential. Okay, and essential also is interference management. So we do use a lot of directional antennas just in order to keep out the interference. Yeah. And funny enough, we are supported by ISPs because we're still at that range where we're so small compared to regular ISPs that actually they see us as an invention lab where we're not really a threat to them. And you know, they're supporting us with know-how, with helping us splicing fiber, things like that, small things. Yeah? So often this happens, you know, when techies talk with techies and there's a veering involved, so there's a six-pack being handed over.
Can you say a little more about, I understand that you're
yeah.
too small to bother them, but do they see some advantage?
Yes, actually those ISPs who help us do get regular updates of what we're doing and what we're inventing. And what, for example, the oldest art development is doing right now. So they get informed, you know, that's pretty valuable for them.
There's another side to this. They're bringing in customers these people never had before.
Yeah.
They walk away from them.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah.
Well, they're bringing in, they're bringing in users.
People users.
Consume, so to speak,
New customers.
Who end up paying.
Who end up consuming bandwidth.
Bandwidth, which we buy.
Which they buy.
Okay. Yeah. And also the city of Vienna is helping us in some a foundation of the internet, private foundation of Austria helped us also. So thanks to them. So I just got this picture before this talk. This is the first first owned fiber. Really own fiber connection. the other one was like shared, but this is we're starting to dig. It's really exciting for me. And the other thing where I'm really focusing on is the development of the mesh protocol, OLSR, because it's so essential. It's really the glue. And I think we're pretty done with scalability. You can go higher to millions, but I think we're now in the thousands range, which is good already. I want to look at different aspects of it now. I want to have routing packets signed, because in Wi-Fi you can introduce any packet into the air at any moment. So if you have a routing packet from OLSR saying, I know where everybody else in the world is, route to me, then you can be very easily a black hole, or you can intercept traffic. So it's in that aspect, we're still very, very vulnerable. So we have to really work on something that, interestingly enough, the military is also interested in, signed routing. So we will only accept routing packets by nodes that we know. This is going to be an interesting aspect, you know, what it means like for the whole structure of the network. Who decides who is welcome or not? That's a good question. But we will need something like that. Otherwise, it's just one single idiot can destroy the routing. So I have no better solution. Maybe you have. Then there is an algorithm from the ISAIS protocol, which will make it converge really rapidly in case the routing tables are out of sync. It's called CSN algorithm. And I want to end up, this is probably in a couple of years, with multipath routing. So the packets get sent out in parallel over multiple paths. So it can balance out like water flowing through different pipes. It's a dream. There are dissertations about it, but it's not easy to implement. quicker conversions, I said that before. And I'm starting with, I think I can say that, with Sasha Meinrad and a few other people in the EU. I'm starting something which will push for more open frequencies. And I'm hoping maybe one of you here in this room has some ideas or some connections to important people who have been already doing that in the EU. Maybe we can link up with more work which is done in the States for opening up the spectrum. I think this is essential. This will be the basis for the future. And yeah, thanks. And I want to say one more thing. I forgot to add that to the slides. Why do I think that spectrum is so important? Because in the future, we're going to see more developments in the area of nanotech radios. So I don't know if everybody of you in the room saw that MIT tech breakthrough, whatever, 2008, I think it was 2008 report. A group in Berkeley by Professor Zettel managed to make radio receivers, antennas, with nanotubes, with carbon nanotubes. So these are 200 nanometers long. And once you have those, they were able to receive a normal FM radio and amplify it. And once you have those in parallel, you have that phased array again. And you can have really the wireless switch, and that's what we need. We need to be able to listen only in that direction and disregard any interference from a different direction. And then once we're there with a wireless switch, we can really scale up Wi-Fi very highly. So, yeah, thanks. Okay, let me see. I think it's here. This one?
Yeah.
No.
No, that's it.
That's it?
Yep.
Yeah, good.
Right. In the spirit of time here this afternoon, I'm just going to cover a couple of quick OAB history perspectives for you all, and then move over to Gabe, who's going to attempt to differentiate a little bit between the technology that Aaron was talking about and the approach that we're trying to pursue in a pilot network that we have going in the Fenway and Mission Hill areas of Boston right now. Right, so again, we think now more than ever is the right time for this in our area. Times are pretty tough, we could argue very easily, in a lot of our neighborhoods, and it's a great time to be able to try to pass along free or ultra-low-cost internet access to our neighborhoods. We studied this a while ago. I think this is left over to some of the mayor's task force initiatives, but the broadband adoption being traditionally low, and the question line is not necessarily that it's too expensive. It's often that it's not necessarily relevant to people's day-to-day lives. And this is really important for OAB as we think about our business plan with, you know, the notion of stimulus money in front of us, about, you know, we're hearing a lot of things about rural unserved communities and such, but I think there's a strong case to be made that there's tremendous and underserved areas in the urban environments where there are dramatic amounts of people that need to learn a little bit more about how internet might be able to help them in their daily lives. I just skipped over the second part of that. So anyway, to most of you guys are all pros of this. You know that we're traditionally behind the eight ball a little bit in terms of our own broadband penetration. And, you know, in studying some of our areas in Mission, Maine, where we're working, it's pretty much one provider in that housing development. And if you can't afford or can't take that one provider, you really don't have a lot of options. So we really feel like we can present something in a community like that can be of tremendous appeal to folks in terms of choice. But choice and cost is not everything. And you'll see as I talk for a little bit how we're trying to take our business approach to be a little bit more oriented, trying to bring up the adoption rate any way that we possibly can. And really, this isn't a focal point of the ISPs, as you've pointed out. And we actually do think that they could become good partners over time with us in terms of seeing a new class of user at the entry-level point that could be brought up to all sorts of levels of connectivity. And I've often said that OAB doesn't provide HBO Gold, so we really, there's lots of things that we don't do. There's just tremendous differentiation. So we think the creation of new businesses is a tremendous idea on an open network, you know, where you have access to the nodes. And, you know, Robin's smiling because this is something that was all over the mayor's task force agenda. We want to be able to engage the community and create economic opportunity, but we also want to be able to create a system that new applications can be thought out, rolled out, and developed out that could benefit the community. And going back a step, Open Air Boston was a group that was set up as a nonprofit out of the mayor's task force to provide wireless broadband network for the city. Primarily goals were, to bring broadband access and computer literacy to underserved neighborhoods and to create a platform for innovation. And I won't read that for you. You can plainly read it yourselves. Where we are trying to differentiate ourselves in the communities is that there have been lots of programs that provide computers and labs and public computing infrastructure. There's a lot of computer programs that provide connectivity, and there's lots of training programs out there. But what we want to try to do is pull it all together, along with a heartfelt commitment to actually coming into the neighborhoods and understanding what is true and relevant and important in those communities that we serve. It's very different what Mission Maine requires of us than what Fenway requires of us. Completely different application suite, completely different engagement. And we want to be very, very specific about trying to do the right things in the right communities and engage the right people in what we're calling a four-pillar strategy, that it really is the computers and the training and the connectivity and the community all coming together to pull together a solution. If we can pull all these things together, we think we're going to do a much better job at bringing up the adoption rate, because it's not just about cheap internet. It's about relevance and about education and about training. So we're taking an approach that is small and grassroots, community-driven. We're calling them open zones, O-zones. You'll hear that a few different ways, open zone, I guess. You know, we know that we can start very, very inexpensively with a fiber optic access point or even a low-end line and pass along those connections down the road to the users through the mesh. It gives time to learn what the needs are of the community, time to educate leaders and engage the service providers who are already there on the ground providing essential services to these communities, and time to create the relevant and targeted training programs with and within the community groups. I should note a point over here that one of the advantages that Open Air Boston has in its relationship with the city is tremendous amount of assets. I was laughing at Aaron talking about the 10 buildings that they got at the beginning. And of course, the city has done a wonderful job to give us any rooftop that we require on the city, as well as some of the utility and traffic rights of way, and some fiber optic access points that we, and our first one is up and running at the Fenway Fire Alarm Communications Headquarters building, right in the Fenway. And that's the one that we're emanating out our Fenway and our Mission Hill network. These are tremendous assets in a tremendously advantaged position. And I think another thing that Aaron has mentioned, and Gabe may talk about this as well, is what they're saying to some of their users is, if you want a node, go build one. You provide the rooftop, right, Aaron? You provide the rooftop, you provide the node, you deal with your landlord, you have that argument. We love that, but we're in the middle of trying to provide our backbone structure node. We're taking a lot of the relationships with some of the private landlords and tenants. Very difficult thing. So if you know a friendly rooftop landlord kind of scenario, we're all ears. This is a little bit of an eye chart. I can send this to you guys later. It's really just to show all the different groups and partnerships, community groups, private partnerships, and foundations that we're bringing together to try to make Open Air Boston work. Key thing for me is that we're going to follow the absolute needs that we hear from our partners in the community, and we're going to build a free network that is extensible by the end users. You want to build something on top of this network? Build it. Go at it. We want to pay for it by research grants. We want this to be a philanthropic outpost, but we also realize that some of the potential of business and research partnerships that might allow us to create new and interesting and innovative applications that will serve the needs of the city and the communities are really exciting for us. And we're really as eager and excited about the unintended consequences that might come out of a free and open network as we are in any other aspects of it. We also think there's a huge opportunity for hyper local sponsorships. That sounds like a whole lot of buzzwords, but I will just tell you that as a 501c3, I can't say advertising, but really, I'm talking about the ability to splash down at a user that's near, let's just say, a local pizza shop or a local coffee shop. You know, that, you know, it's 10 o'clock in the morning, you want a coffee fix. You know, your neighborhood coffee shop is the place you want to go. And we can provide, we feel like there's an awful lot of local sponsorship of this network that can derive a lot of value. A lot of business can derive a lot of value from those kinds of location-based services. And I know when Aaron's talking about VoIP, I say absolutely. VoIP as well is a huge, huge, huge of focus point of ours as well. All right, so Gabe's going to talk a little bit about the technology innovation, the differentiation between the open air approach and what you've heard from our good friend Aaron.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to start by making explicit some things that I think were implicit in both presentations, and that really is what's different between what Aaron's doing and his colleagues are doing in Europe, which is amazing, what cities like Philadelphia and San Francisco tried, Minneapolis tried in terms of trying to build citywide Wi-Fi networks, and what our new model is here in Boston. As you all know, cities like Minneapolis, like Philadelphia, they tried very large-scale, top-down approaches that functioned very much like an ISP, and they failed miserably. I think you probably know a good deal of the story. If you don't, there's an article that Sasha Meinrath wrote called The Philadelphia Story from the New America Foundation, which I'd encourage you to check out. Aaron's approach is about as opposed to that as you can get. It's very, very geek-centric, very, very bottom-up. You know, you want a node, you go out and build it on your rooftop, you know, and it's been absolutely wonderful. The success that it's achieved all over Europe, not in one city, but in a dozen cities, has been absolutely tremendous. This is something that's replicable. This is something that's financially sustainable, which, you know, those big ISPs building, you know, Earthlink, they were not financially sustainable. Aaron is. Amazing. The one thing, you know, what we really see, Aaron, as being almost like having done some work for us that we can now, can use as a platform to build a network that's not as top-down as an ISP like Earthlink, but it's also a little bit less chaotic and a little bit more planned and centralized. I am speaking fast here. I do want to respect all your time. So we have this great collaboration with the city, you know, mayors and technology advisors over here. We have resources from the city, assets from the city. Brian alluded to fiber optic links and building tops. We have the ability to work with universities and to work with corporations. We have a little bit more standardization in terms of the hardware that we're going to be using. So, you know, we're certainly more than happy to work with you to use the hardware that you want if you're, you know, some geek out living in Fenway or Mission Hill. But we've really got a set that we've got running now, and that means that we can build something that's really seamless, that we can hand you a box that you can plug in your window and it will work. So the thing that we're really borrowing from Aaron is, you know, we have a very small paid staff, which is essentially myself and Aaron. Even Brian here isn't getting paid. at the moment, excuse me. But we really need a really great base of volunteers who can do technology work, who can do marketing work, who can do fundraising work, who can do all sorts of different things. And we think that by having a little bit more, I hate to say this because it sounds like an insult to Aaron, but it's not, professionalized, he's very professional, but professional in a different way, centralized approach, we can really hit some goals that have not necessarily been the focus of the geek-centric networks in Europe, as wonderful as they are. And those goals are really digital inclusion, taking these neighborhoods where adoption rates of broadband are so low and offering this free solution combined with low-cost computers, combined with training, working with the infrastructure that's been in place in these neighborhoods, computer centers that are offering great training programs already. And we think that the result is a program that's really going to enable people to become a new generation of technology users. Now, Comcast and Verizon may not see this. They may be too short-sighted to understand this. But we really think that somebody who's using a wireless network, who's got the free connection, gets the low-cost computer, they're going to get hooked on that. And they may go out and buy a brand new computer. And they may go out and say, you know, this wireless connection, you know, I can't download all the movies, you know, that I want 24 hours a day on this. It's just not enough for me, for my gigs and gigs of traffic. So I'm going to go out and get a Comcast connection. You know, we saw from that previous slide that 50% of the people who do not have broadband do not see it as relevant of the households in Boston. And I think it was 47% saw it as too expensive. So of that 90, we can address that 97%. You know, those people who may have that wire line to their house, but it's either too expensive or it's not relevant, we can make it relevant and we can make it free. And that's something, you know, we really hope that the ISPs will see the value of. As you all know, Comcast and Verizon are not the most enlightened companies. So.
When they say not relevant, what specifically?
Well, I think that if you're someone who's working in a service job, who's living in housing development, you may not have a lot of experience on the internet. you know, or with computers. You may not be using it in your job, and you may not, you know, you may not know much about using the internet to access government services, using the internet to access distance learning, using the internet for fun, for YouTube. So I think that a lot of that not relevant just comes from, it's not something that I use in my daily life. And if $50 a month is a big expense, you know, why should I shell that out if I don't really have, if, you know, I have only this sort of vague notion that maybe it's something that my kids will enjoy. Yeah.
What prevents you from combining your approach, which I know a bit about, with the thing in Europe, and also setting it up so that the mesh network can expand
organically
through hands-on people taking initiative to take an old access point and put it up on the roof?
Yeah, I think maybe I didn't really say that very clearly. I guess I was sort of alluding to that is something that we really want to do as well. But, you know, we sort of have this focus that we have an area that we want to build out. But there are people, Steve Ronan here has built networks in housing developments all over the city, you know, and we want to sort of encompass those networks.
Yeah, but I think that the absolute answer is positively. In fact, as soon as we can, we'll put an area up on the website where people can, you know, buy two access points and give one to a friend, and you know, we absolutely want it to grow organically by the community.
Yeah, please.
I will speak inadequately for Esther Hargitay, who unfortunately isn't here today, but that would be interesting. She's a fellow at the center, and she's on the faculty at Northwestern, where she, in particular, the sociologist who studies the skill sets, what keeps people from moving on to the net, and in particular the skill sets. So, when you say training, what sort of training? Is it the basic skills, or is it also training that will get people to appreciate what there is on the net, get them over the, it doesn't matter?
Our funding from, this is a wonderful way for me to plug our funder here. Our funder is Timothy Smith Network, and they've offered $100,000 to do a network in Fenway and Mission Hill. Our funder has developed a set of curricula that we've used that's a number of different lessons that are just incredibly practical two-page lessons. So for things like, how do you look up flight arrival at Logan Airport? How do you apply for food stamps? You know, how do you figure out the Massachusetts health insurance requirements? You know, how do you do things that you might have had to go to an office and wait all day to do? How do you do those online? Very, very simple, practical stuff.
I mean, things that people actually like doing.
Yeah,
like
that's stuff that we have not put into lessons yet. That I think that that's another real key component because, you know, people talk about these networks. You know, we can use these networks to do distance learning and, you know, healthcare and et cetera, but if somebody uses MySpace, you know, they may get hooked on MySpace. They're not necessarily going to look at a manual for how to do healthcare online, but you know, if they learn how to use MySpace and they get hooked on it, you know, maybe it'll be just so easy for them to Google search for how to health information that it'll just become part of their routine. In a sense, that a training program that's designed to just do a lesson about healthcare may not offer. I don't know if I expressed that quite as clearly as I intended.
Could interrupt with two other quick things. And Colin and I talked about Esther's a visiting professor, I guess, right? And another one of our partners is the Technology Goes Home program. And so if you look at families with their school-age kid doing project-based learning to help them understand how they and a family can grow together and use the network to benefit, that's I think huge and wonderful program. And I love the idea that that grows into wonderful breadth of curriculum around things from internet safety and security, talking about MySpace, to things like, you know, how one might produce videos for YouTube or seed the community cable networks or, you know, for video programming. So I think there's wonderful opportunities with a number of different partners to try to see relevant where the relevant programs are. And actually, I think that's something really studyable, because the truth is, the real answer is we don't know 100% of the
exactly
answer.
That's what Esther has been studying. So.
Yeah.
I'd be very, very interested in reading her.
We absolutely want to do that.
What's the vision for expanding beyond the privilege
and the service of the community? Look, we're doing Mission Hill, but we're also doing Fenway. You know, so we know, this is a lesson learned, for those of you who are familiar with the Grove Hall project, the lesson that we've learned from it, did I commit a faux pas?
No.
The lesson that we've learned there is that we have to engage everybody. So they're going to be very young, tech-savvy people who are students who are living in the Fenway who are going to be our volunteer base.
Excuse me, sir.
Who are, you know, going to be very engaged by this network. There are going to be small businesses who we can help with things like transaction processing, who we can help with things like local advertising to do, you know, promote their business. There are going to be low-income community that we've talked about. And I guess I started with the low-income community, so, you know, I may have given the impression that this was a network that was just, you know, for that purpose. But it's really a citywide network, you know, and we're building Fenway at the same time that we're building Mission Hill.
So what kind of pushback do you get from the duopoly merchant service? I can afford the $50,000,
but I have to get it. I think that remains to be seen.
Yeah, you know, honestly, we talk about it and we've had very open and honest conversations with those companies. There's not this, you know, huge clamoring and enormous pushback. It's just a question about understanding how everybody's business model can properly coexist. I really look forward to having great relationships with those enterprises. And there, you know, I think when I've talked a bit about this in other environments, you know, we're not the phone company. We're not the cable company. We were engaged by our colleagues from the city. We were engaged by you all and people who live in Boston and surrounding areas to say, who have said, let's all get together and build ourselves a network. It's the furthest thing from the phone company. It's the furthest thing. So I think there's lots of wonderful opportunities to build together, learn together, share together. I love that.
Thank you very much.
Good job, guys. I was very encouraged by what Aaron said about the ISPs really getting that they get early information about top-notch routing protocol and how they might anticipate putting it on the network. I think the sky's the limit. We have not even begun to, you know, to look at how well we're going to be working together with these enterprises.
I want to talk briefly about some of the innovation stuff and just wrap up. If there aren't any more, I didn't see any more hands. So, the innovation piece. Aaron, one of the things that has happened in Austria and elsewhere in Europe is that this network has really become a test bed for all sorts of very interesting, innovative projects around wireless networking. They're doing all sorts of tests of different protocols. There's now, you know, another protocol that's emerged in Berlin called Batman that, you know, so they're now almost competing camps. So Vienna likes one protocol, Berlin likes the other. And, you know, people are really engaged and they're creating innovative ideas because this network exists. So one of the key things that this page is about is that, this slide is about, is that once you have the network, then people are going to come together and create innovative solutions. And that's something that can be leveraged by the great universities in the Boston area. And it can be something of a bottom-up process that, you know, the network exists. People come in and help us out with some of the innovation. These are students at universities, perhaps. The professors become interested. And, our ultimate goal is to have a wireless innovation center that really does top-notch research. And that is done with a collaboration of multiple universities in the area. So these are just a list of applications. And as you can see, there are applications that are for a wide variety of different groups. There's applications for businesses. There are applications for students who are very tech savvy. There are applications that are great for people who have not used computers very much. One key thing that we really want to do is we really want to do a great captive portal solution so that you log into the network, you hit this captive portal, it's a great community site, and you know, we can have things like who's on the network? What's their connection to the network like? We can do some different exchanges between users. We can do exchanges between the users and the managers of the network, so they let us know what we need to do to improve the network. Nonprofits can use this to advertise events. Businesses can use it, and this may be part of our business model, that businesses can, you know, sponsor little ads on the network, et cetera. Aaron really talked about VoIP as a killer app. That's a big priority for us. Video surveillance is a very interesting application. You know, very low cost access to video surveillance that you can, if you think your store is being vandalized, you can watch it at night. That's something that the community Mission Hill might really take to. And Fenway as well. I don't want to.
We struggle every time we generate a list like that, because really we're trying to say that we want to go through and learn this, so it changes every time we go and sit and talk to people, because the truth is we're really not necessarily the application providers. We're really trying to be an enabler of ideas, so if anybody wants to throw some ideas on the board there, we're all ears.
These are more traditional applications of a wireless network. You know, you walk down the Avenue of the Arts in the Fenway, and you know, you want to see where the best place to park is, what the hours are for the Museum of Fine Arts. My favorite that I bring up at every meeting, because I absolutely hate it, is I want to know where the 66 bus is, because it's never on schedule, and it's freezing cold outside, and you know, if I could get an alert like 3 minutes before and run out, that would be fantastic.
I don't even know why I need to go to the big box where the bus comes. Why doesn't it go where me and my best friends are standing?
Stop the little thing. Yeah.
It's all about approaching the utilities. So one thing that's happening, particularly with the
electric grid, is you're moving to advanced please.
And believe it or not, they don't necessarily use the power lines as a way to
no problem.
Meters. They're often using other things like Wi-Fi, that might be a vehicle as a fairly low balance application. It might be a vehicle that you can piggyback on certain areas and stuff like that. It might be a partnership that we can strike up these kind of things.
Yeah, I absolutely want to try to get out to the to the utilities. So we've had a conversation recently with Boston Housing Authority. We envisioned a mesh network to provide an amenity of internet access for the patrons of housing. You can also imagine that they really pay an awful lot for heating of the public areas. And really, you know, you might keep your temperature at 68, you might have it at 85 and have the window open. It would be nice to actually get some sensors and, you know, monitor what's going on. So I think there's a huge opportunity on the mesh to do some very, very basic level measurement. So if anybody has any great connections at NSTOP. Hang on, a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see.
So
evaluation.
No, and we should really state that we're very, very early in the Fenway Mission Hill. There's a network about a mile built that Gabe alluded to earlier in Grove Hall that's been up about a year and a half or so. The numbers of initial interest were very, very peaked in the initial phase, and as it, this is one of the ones that was trying to look at a low cost model, and the cost structure was represented for a variety of reasons. The usership went way down, so we're trying to reevaluate that. The Fenway and Mission Hill area is very, very new. There's just a few nodes up and running in Fenway, and as the weather is starting to get nicer, we're going to look to explode that really, really quickly with open mesh devices.
Okay. Can I just run through? We have just a little closing slide here. And that's just to say, we'd love to work with Berkman to see, what we can do in terms of, you know, using the network as a platform for research, in terms of developing grants, research initiatives.
I put the Kadai rooftops we can use in there.
Yeah. The key thing right now, you know, obviously a network that's being run by the community is requires volunteers. So I have a sign-up sheet here that's for our mailing list. We have an announce list. We have a tech discuss list. Tech discussion list is pretty low volume. I'll pass it around again. It got passed around very before we started. And we also have a little box for volunteers. But, you know, we have, as I alluded to earlier, we have opportunities for people to help us in all areas. They could be helping us with programs to train people, to hand out notes to people in low-income areas. It could be helping us with the technology. We really want to build a great software development team here in Boston. Great wireless radio team in Boston. You know, these are things that have developed in Europe. There's no reason we can't have them here. And, you know, we also need the kind of help that every other organization needs, you know, in terms of fundraising, in terms of marketing, in terms of, you know, sort of mundane stuff. Our biggest stumbling block has been working with private buildings to get spots on roofs. This is one place where Aaron's approach of, you know, very much, you know, accepting people as they come in has you know, it's been very convenient for him. As we go in and try to plan to build an area at a time, we have to approach these private landlords. I don't know how many of you are there any property owners here? Any building landlords, I should say? Okay. Other than the people in this room, I would say that property owners are not only very difficult people who love to, they're so concerned about liability, and they're just very difficult to reach, and it's just been a stumbling block for us. And as our organization grows, we'll be better equipped to handle these landlords and to say, all right, you have a, you know, such and such insurance requirements, we can really, you know, we're now large enough that we can meet those.
Maybe even the broad category, we talk about rooftop access and stuff, but just really the broad category of liability insurance for a small nonprofit in this kind of business is very eye-opening.
But anyway, I say all this.
Yeah, like, there's a question.
I'm sorry.
You might want to try and going in, take your list of advantages, go to a landlord and say, if you had this wireless here, this is the type of advantages you can offer to the people in your building.
Yeah.
And so you turn it from a liability into a benefit for them, and that they could then charge additional money.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we've certainly tried to talk about, you know, does this benefit property values, and you know, and hopefully we'll make some headway. You know, we're working, for example, we really want to cover the Christian Science Plaza in the Fenway. You know, it's a wonderful public space, and you know, the Christian Science Church and the Mary Baker Eddy, one of those library, you know, they really get that this is something. There are people who are coming to this space. They're, you know, they may be students, they may be elderly people who are sort of congregating. There are people who could really benefit from this, and it makes it a better experience. You know, having the plaza a better experience, and it helps them. Not all landlords see it that way, and you know, we do need to do a better job of being more explicit. I think that's really a great idea. But I just want to say that. All that by way of saying that if you happen to own any buildings in Fenway or Mission Hill, just please let me know. And, you know, that's our contact information. I don't know, Brian, if you have any closing words there.
Yep, we're on our website. We're Twitter, Facebook stuff is out there. We really do hope to create a social model of networking so people out there on Twitter can tell us where the signal is strong and where it's not so strong. So we can react in a different sort of way. With that, I really, really, really want to thank you all for coming and listening to us. And we've gone over time. And I appreciate your indulgence.
Our emails are brian@openairboston. Okay, you clap first. brian@openairboston.net, gabe@openairboston.net.